You ever look at something and just know it's too far gone? I mean, really look at it. Sun-bleached aluminum, sand in every rivet hole. Coyotes probably using the bomb bay as a bedroom. That's what a handful of dreamers saw when they laid eyes on a B-29 superfortress sitting in the California desert in 1987. And where most folks would have shaken their heads and walked away, these people saw an airplane that could fly again. I'm Tail Dragger, and this is the Hangar On Radio Hangar. Pull up a chair, because this one's a love story. A love story between a city, an airplane, and about 300,000 hours of volunteer labor. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. So let's go back. The airplane we're talking about is a Boeing B-29 Superfortress, serial number 4461748. She rolled off the assembly line in Wichita, Kansas, in 1944. Built by the hands of Kansas workers, many of them women, in the same Boeing plant that was churning out superfortresses as fast as the war demanded them. She was given the name Doc after one of the seven dwarfs. See, there was a whole flight of B-29s at the training base that got named after Snow White's little crew. You had Doc, Grumpy, Bashful, the whole bunch. Most of those airplanes went to war in the Pacific. Doc saw service, did her time, and when the shooting stopped, the military didn't need her anymore. Now, here's where it gets interesting. Instead of being scrapped like thousands of her sisters, Doc ended up at the Naval Weapons Center at China Lake, out in the Mojave Desert. The Navy used her as a target, not a flying target, mind you, a ground target. They'd test missiles and munitions around her, see what the blast effects would do. For decades, she just sat there, baking. The desert sun does terrible things to an airplane. The winds sandblast the skin, critters move in, hydraulic lines dry out and crack, rubber seals turn to powder. She was a hulk, a shell of what Boeing had built. But she was still there. That's the thing about the B-29. She was over-engineered in ways that people don't appreciate anymore. The pressurized fuselage, the fire control system, the remote-controlled gun turrets. This was the most complex production airplane of World War II, and even after 40 years of neglect in the desert, the basic structure was still sound. The spars were good, the skin was repairable, the bones of the airplane were intact. In 1987, a man named Tony Mussolini spotted her. Tony was a Cleveland aviation enthusiast, and he had a vision. He wanted to save one of these airplanes. At the time, the only flying B-29 in the world was Fifi, operated by the Commemorative Air Force down in Texas. One flying example of the airplane that ended World War II. One, out of nearly 4,000 built. Tony looked at Doc and saw the second. Getting her off that Navy range was its own battle. We're talking about a military installation in the middle of the desert. Paperwork, permissions, environmental reviews. It took years just to get authorization to move the airplane. They finally got the green light, and a team of volunteers disassembled Doc enough to truck her out of China Lake. They moved major components by road across the desert and eventually back to Wichita, back home, back to the city where she was born. And that's when the real work started. The volunteers set up shop in a hangar, and they began what would become one of the most ambitious warbird restorations in American history. I want you to understand the scale of this. A B-29 is not a small airplane. Wingspan of 141 feet, fuselage over 99 feet long. Four Wright R-3350 engines, each one producing 2,200 horsepower. Each engine has 18 cylinders arranged in two rows. The propeller assemblies alone weigh hundreds of pounds apiece. The pressurization system was revolutionary for its time, but a nightmare to rebuild, and every single system on that airplane had to be taken apart, inspected, repaired or replaced, and put back together. They didn't have a factory. They didn't have a fleet of paid engineers. They had retirees. They had Boeing workers who came in after their day shifts. They had machinists and sheet metal guys and electricians who donated their weekends, their vacations, their evenings. Some of these folks had actually built B-29s during the war. Imagine that. Coming back 60 years later to put one together again, your hands remembering what your mind had almost forgotten. The wing spars had to be inspected inch by inch using ultrasound and dye-penetrant testing. You can't guess with a spar. You either trust it or you don't fly. They found corrosion in places. They found fatigue cracks. Each one had to be evaluated. Can it be repaired? Does it need a new section fabricated? Where do you even find the tooling for a part that hasn't been manufactured since 1945? The answer, more often than not, was you make it. These volunteers fabricated parts from scratch. They found original Boeing drawings, blueprints that had been archived and nearly forgotten. They tracked down vendors who still had raw materials in the right alloys. They machined new fittings on manual lathes. One volunteer told a reporter that he spent an entire winter building a single bracket, one bracket, because it had to be right. The engines were a saga all by themselves, Wright R3350 duplex cyclones. These are massive, complex radial engines. Finding four that could be rebuilt to flying condition took years of searching. They sourced engines and parts from surplus dealers, from museums, from other restoration projects that had stalled. Each engine was completely disassembled, every bearing inspected, every cylinder honed, every valve lapped. The turbochargers, those big exhaust-driven superchargers that gave the B-29 its high-altitude capability, those had to be rebuilt too. Finding turbine wheels that weren't cracked was like finding gold. The electrical system was another monster. A B-29 has miles of wiring, literally miles, and every foot of it had to be replaced. The original rubber insulation had rotted away decades ago. They rewired the entire airplane using modern wire that met the original specifications but wouldn't crumble in your hands. The junction boxes, the bus bars, the circuit breakers all rebuilt or replaced. The remote gun turret system, that amazing General Electric fire control computer that let a single gunner aim turrets on different parts of the airplane, they decided not to restore that to operational condition. Too complex, too many missing components, and frankly, you don't need to shoot at anybody at an air show. But the pressurization system, they brought that back. That matters. The B-29 was designed to fly above 25,000 feet, above the weather and above most of the Japanese fighter defense. Without pressurization, she's just a very large, very slow bomber. Getting those seals right, getting the bleed air system from the engines to actually hold cabin pressure, that was one of the last and hardest pieces of the puzzle. The propellers were Hamilton standard units, huge four-bladed constant speed props. Each blade is over 8 feet long. The hub assemblies had to be overhauled, the governors rebuilt, the de-icing systems tested. When those props are turning, each one sweeps a circle over 16 feet in diameter. Standing near them on the ramp, you feel it in your chest before you hear it. Year after year, the work continued. The project ran into funding problems more than once. There were times when it looked like Doc might never fly. The money would dry up, volunteers would age out, parts would prove harder to find than anyone expected. But the core group held on. They formed a nonprofit called Doc's Friends to manage fundraising and keep the restoration organized. The community in Wichita rallied. Boeing itself donated hangar space and engineering support. Local businesses chipped in materials and services. This airplane became Wichita's airplane. The city that built her was going to see her fly again. The sheet metal work alone took years. Thousands of rivets had to be drilled out and replaced. Skin panels that were too corroded to save were fabricated from new aluminum sheet, formed to match the original contours. The bomb bay doors were rebuilt. The nose glazing, that distinctive greenhouse nose of the B-29, was refitted with new plexiglass panels shaped to the original molds. When the sunlight hit that nose section for the first time after the glazing went in, old-timers on the crew said it looked like 1944 again. They painted her in her original markings, olive drab and gray with the big star and bar on the fuselage, Doc across the nose in block letters. She looked right. She looked like a weapon of war that time had softened into something more like a monument. The first engine run happened in 2016. After all those years, I want you to picture this. A hangar in Wichita. Volunteers who had been working on this airplane for a decade or more standing in a semicircle, some of them with gray hair who'd had dark hair when they started. The inertial starter on engine number 3 winds up, that distinctive rising whine, and then 18 cylinders catch and that right radial comes to life with a bark and a cloud of blue smoke. There's video of it. You can see grown men crying, not embarrassed about it either. They earned those tears. On July 17, 2016, Doc took to the air for the first time in 60 years. The test pilot was Charlie Tilghman, a man with heavy aircraft experience and a steady hand, four engines running, props biting into Kansas air, and that big silver bomber climbed away from McConnell Air Force Base like she'd never stopped flying. She did several test flights, working out the inevitable squawks and snags that come with any airplane that's been rebuilt from the ground up. A fuel leak here, an instrument that reads funny, there, normal stuff, expected stuff. Stuff that years of careful work had minimized but could never entirely eliminate. Since then, Doc has been flying the airshow circuit alongside Fifi, two B-29s flying in formation. For a few years there, it was the only time in decades that you could see two superfortresses in the air at the same time. The sound of eight right radials in formation is something that doesn't translate to a recording. You have to be standing on the flight line. You have to feel that low-frequency rumble in your ribcage. It's not just loud, it's physical. Doc's Friends built a permanent hangar and museum in Wichita, right near the airport. You can go see her when she's home between show seasons, walk under those wings. look up at those engine nacelles, read the names of the volunteers on the walls. 300,000 hours of donated labor. Think about that number. If one person worked 8 hours a day, 5 days a week, 50 weeks a year, it would take them 150 years to put in that many hours. It took a community. What gets me about this story isn't just the airplane, though she's magnificent. It's what it says about the people who do this work. Nobody got rich restoring Doc, nobody got famous. Most of the volunteers will never have their names in a history book. They did it because the airplane mattered to them, because the history mattered, because letting the last generation of people who actually remember World War II pass away without being able to hear those engines one more time felt like a failure they weren't willing to accept. Every warbird restoration is a race against time. The airplanes get older, the parts get scarcer, the people who know how to work on round engines, who understand tube and fabric construction, who can read a Boeing blueprint from 1943, they're not getting any younger. Doc's restoration was a passing of knowledge as much as a rebuilding of an airplane. Older volunteers taught younger ones. Techniques that existed only in the hands of retired machinists got transferred to a new generation. That's the real restoration. Not just the aluminum and the Pratt and Whitney's, sorry, the Wrights. The knowledge, the skill, the stubborn belief that these machines deserve to keep flying. I pulled a lot of this story from the Doc's Friends organization and their published history of the restoration, along with coverage from General Aviation News and several interviews the restoration crew gave over the years. If you're anywhere near Wichita, go see Doc in person at the B-29 Doc Hangar and Education Center. And if you want more stories like this one, we've got them waiting for you at radiohangar.com. Keep the old iron flying, friends. Taildragger out.